This episode of the Axon Creative Podcast is brought to you by Indeed. Right now, Indeed is offering our listeners a free $75 credit to boost your job post, which means more quality candidates will see it fast. Try it out at indeed.com/creative. This episode is also brought to you by Lightstream. Lightstream believes that people with good credit deserve a better loan experience, and that's exactly what they deliver. Learn more at lightstream.com/accidental. Hey everyone, welcome to the Accidental Creative Podcast. My name is Todd Henry. I'm your host. I'm also the author of the brand new book, The Motivation Code, available now wherever books are sold. Hey, just a quick moment of celebration and a moment of thanks. The Accidental Creative Podcast just crossed 10 million downloads, which is a huge milestone for a podcast. And I just want to say thank you to those of you who have been listening to and sharing the podcast for a number of years. Some of you over a decade now have been listening. So thank you so much for taking the time to tune in every week and to share what you learn here with your friends and your peers. So thank you for that from the bottom of my heart. Really appreciate that we continue to be able to do this work. So one of the most important contributors to any good career, any successful career, is that the person typically is able to make good decisions. Now, not always. Sometimes we make bad decisions and luck intervenes and we end up in a place we didn't intend to end up. And, you know, looking back, it looks like we were a genius, but the reality is we made a bad decision that just happened to turn out well. Sometimes we make good decisions that don't turn out well, but generally speaking, when we make good decisions, it tends to lead to more opportunity for us, or at the very least, we live a life with limited regrets. Well, on this episode, we have someone who is an expert in decision making. She's a former world champion poker player. She's also the author of a number of smash-selling books, and her new book is called How to Decide. It's a phenomenal exploration of the decision-making process. And so today, Annie Duke is going to walk us through how to make better decisions in life and in work. Before we dive into that, I want to let you know today's episode is brought to you by Indeed. So 2020 has already reshaped how we work, and it's almost over. Businesses across the globe are challenged to be their most efficient, which means every hire is critical. Indeed is here to help. So Indeed is the number one job site in the world with more total visits than any other job site, according to Comscore. Indeed helps you find quality candidates quickly so you can focus on hiring the right person that you need to keep your business going. Unlike other sites, Indeed gives you full control and payment flexibility over your hiring. So you only pay for what you need and you can pause your account at any time. There are no long-term contracts. And now, Indeed's new way of matching you with candidates instantly delivers a shortlist of quality candidates whose resumes on Indeed match your job criteria that you can contact the moment you sponsor a job, making Indeed the only job site that can move as fast as you do. 73% of online job seekers in the U.S. visit Indeed each month, according to Comscore total visits. So it's clear Indeed can help you get the quality hire you need. That's why more than 3 million businesses worldwide use Indeed for hiring. Right now, Indeed is offering our listeners a free $75 credit to boost your job post, which means more quality candidates will see it fast. Try Indeed out with a free $75 credit at indeed.com/creative. This is their best offer available anywhere. So go right now to indeed.com/creative. Offer valid through December 31st. Terms and conditions apply. And we thank Indeed for sponsoring this episode of the Accidental Creative Podcast. Well, it's so great to have on the show today, Annie Duke. I've been following her work for a long time. She's the author of the smash best-selling book, Thinking in Bets. And she has a brand new book called How to Decide, Simple Tools for Making Better Choices. I can't wait to dive into this conversation. Annie, welcome to the Accidental Creative Podcast.
Thank you for having me.
So as I mentioned, I've been following your work for a long time, and I'm intrigued by how you wound up writing books. I mean, you've had a long and very diverse career. Could you just share a little bit of your background and how you ended up basically teaching people about how to make decisions?
Oh, yeah. So actually, when you think about it, it's accidentally. I feel like the answer is. Okay. So I feel like there's so many different accidental things that have happened in my life that I've just sort of been like, oh, that's kind of a nice bright shiny object. I'll go check that one out. So I started off my post-college life at graduate school at the University of Pennsylvania. And I was doing a 5-year PhD program in cognitive science. So specifically thinking about learning and decision making, but really mostly learning, particularly under uncertain systems, and the topic that I was specifically thinking about probably people wouldn't think was particularly related to things I did later, although it is. We could go into that later if you wanted to. But I was studying how children learn their first language. Mm. It's actually quite a hard problem. Anybody who's tried to learn a second language knows that learning languages are quite hard. But everyone in a 1/2-year-old has it mastered, things that, like, you know, 35-year-olds can't quite figure out. So it's actually kind of an interesting problem. But that was mainly what I was focused on. I was going to go off to a tenure track position. I ended up getting sick at the end of graduate school, and I had to delay going out on my job search for a year. And during that year, I started playing poker, which is particularly at the time was quite a strange thing to start doing, because it was not on television. So you didn't see it on ESPN all the time. And there was no internet poker either. So, you know, the only way that you could actually play poker was in casinos, or in my case, I started off in the basement of a bar in Montana that was called the Crystal Lounge.
So that sounds like the opening line to a country song. Sorry.
Right.
Why poker? Why was that the thing you were attracted to at the time?
Isn't that a funny question? Yeah. So first of all, I needed to do something. I was going to go back out and become a professor, remember? So mm-hmm. I don't want to reboot a new career. I need to do something that's flexible, that can accommodate the fact that I actually didn't feel very well, and so I couldn't play all the time. How did I end up with poker? My brother, Queen's Gambit is so big right now. So I actually have been in rooms where those chess tournaments were occurring, because my brother was quite a good chess player. He had... I feel like his top rating was like 2280. Like, he was really good. And he had his designs on becoming a grandmaster at some point. So he went off to New York when he was like 18 to go study with a grandmaster. And through chess, and that was in the 80s, through chess, he ended up sort of finding his way to poker. And so he had been playing poker for 10 years before any of this happens. And he was playing in like private games in New York City.
Okay.
For a long time, and had really gone through like the school of hard knocks. Like, in the beginning, he lost tons and tons of money. He actually ended up like working for the game, like doing errands for players in the game, in order to be able to pay his buy-ins to the game, because he wasn't very good. And then he eventually started to get really good. And by the time all of this happens to me, he's already made it to the final table of the World Series of Poker at 23 years old. So I knew a little bit about poker. I'd watched him play quite a bit. He had given me a few pointers, and he's the one who actually suggested, well, maybe you should play poker. So that's how I started playing. But then once I actually was playing, I just really fell in love with the game. It's a really interesting problem, like, nut to try to crack, to make decisions under uncertainty in that way. You know, you can't see other people's cards. There's lots and lots of luck involved. It presents quite a hard learning problem in figuring out, like, why did I lose? Because you don't really know, right? Like, did I make bad decisions? Did I get bad luck? That's really hard. Why did I win? Did I make good decisions? Did I get good luck? What was it, some combination? What's the balance of that? How do I figure out how to narrow down what people might hold? And that's aside from all the math that's involved. So it was just this really interesting kind of real life instantiation of the kinds of things that I was studying in graduate school, but this time, like, for a lot of money at stake.
Yeah.
And I just loved it. So what I was going to do in the meantime, just to make some money until I went back to go get my PhD to finish that up. And I stopped like 2 weeks before getting my PhD. Like, I'm as ABD as you get. What I was going to do in the meantime ended up being something I did for 18 years. So then the question is, like, obviously, like, how did I end up writing books, which becomes even more accidental. So about 8 years into playing poker, a friend of mine, Eric Seidel, got asked to come speak to a group of options traders about how poker, how the game of poker might inform their thinking about risk. But my friend Eric Seidel does not like speaking in front of large groups of people, or even small ones, frankly. But he knew that when I was at Penn, obviously, when you're a graduate student, you end up teaching classes. So he knew that I had taught at Penn, and said, you know, oh, you should ask Annie. She'd probably want to do that, and she'd be pretty good at it. So he then referred that over to me. Remember, they weren't even looking for me. They were looking for Eric Seidel. So he referred me. I ended up doing it. And that guy, Roger Lowe, ended up referring me out to other people. And I just started kind of building. I said, oh, you know, this is actually, I really did like academics. And I liked thinking about all of these things in a little bit more of an academic way as well, besides this very practical high stakes application of this. And these create a really interesting conversation between the two disciplines, the more academic work sort of with this very practical application of the academic work. And I said, I really like this collision here that I'm now thinking about in a really intentional way. And so I started sort of diving into that collision and built myself like a speaking and consulting business. I overlapped that with poker for about 10 years, but actually the majority of my time was spent on that and not on poker. It's just that the poker part of my life people saw on television. So I think that people didn't realize what the sort of balance of my time was. And then in 2012, I rolled out of that because at some point along the way, I had this idea that I really, that there were two books that I wanted to write. And one was thinking about how might the academic way that you might think about decision making inform better poker play. And that was a book that I wrote that I published in, I think, 2011, that was called Decide to Play Great Poker. And that was really saying, like, I want to think about poker through a decision making framework. And I did want to write that book. So I did. But the other book that I wanted to write was Thinking in Bets, which was, how do you think about the way that poker might inform the way that you think about decision making? So sort of the mirror image of that first book, which I obviously ended up writing. I've now written like 7 books, but that was really, I mean, it was all sort of this weird, windy accident. Oh, combined with the fact that I double majored in college, and one of them was English literature. So I guess I kind of knew how to write.
Yeah, well, you know, like you say, an accident, but it's sort of like a confluence, it sounds like, you know, in so many ways. It's you being in the right place when opportunity arises, and then you had the experience to be able to leverage that experience in those moments in order to take a step forward, or in order to be useful in some way, and that you sort of worked your way into what you're doing now. And what's interesting to me about the story is that I feel like poker is such a great analog for business decision making. I mean, it really, really is, because you only know what you know. You don't know what everybody else knows. And yet you're still trying to make decisions and take risks in the midst of all of this uncertainty. And you write in the new book, How to Decide, being a better decision maker means being a better predictor of the set of possible futures. Mm-hmm. So could you talk about what that means? Because I think we all feel that. We like that resonated with me deeply when I read that. But could you describe what that means in a little more detail?
Sure. Yeah. So I think it's interesting because I personally think that this doesn't get said enough, that what a decision really is a forecast. Hmm. So you can think about a weather forecast, right? What does it tell you? You know, 30% of the time, there's a 30% chance of rain tomorrow. Maybe there's, you know, a 50% chance that it's just going to be overcast. And there's a 20% chance that it'll be sunny or partially sunny, right? So it's really what a weather forecast is telling you is what the possible futures are. And any decision that we make is really a forecast in the same sense. It's a prediction about what the future might hold for us. And because of the nature of the world, it's not a prediction about one future, because there's lots and lots of different ways that the future could turn out, even for incredibly simple decisions. Like if I proceed through a green light, there's not just one future that could happen, which is I just go through the green light and I go merrily on my way. I mean, obviously I could get in an accident. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, obviously you can get more granular than that, right? Like I could not get in an accident, but I could end up swerving off the road trying to avoid someone who's coming at me, or you know, it could be a minor fender bender, my car could get totaled, so on and so forth. So we can think about what those possible outcomes are. So even for a simple decision, there's lots of different ways it can turn out. And what we're trying to do is figure out, for any decision that we make, what is the sort of best set of possibilities that I think are going to occur, where best is defined both by the quality of the outcome itself and the probability of that outcome occurring, right? So you're trying for that combo.
Well,
I want to make sure that the good stuff, I'm going to make a decision where the good stuff is going to happen the most frequently.
Yeah. And that's something that you clarify in the book that was also very helpful to me. There's a difference between outcome quality and decision quality, right? I mean, you can make a good decision and still have a bad outcome potentially.
Yeah, I mean, exactly. And I think the traffic light example is a really good one, which we can all understand because it's very clear to us whether the decision, you know, whether the decision is good or bad because it's already settled. So think about going through the traffic light. What I'm saying is that I'm making a prediction that if I go on green, I'm going to have a much higher likelihood of having a good outcome than if I go on red. Mm-hmm. Right. So that decision in itself is a prediction of the future. Right. It's a forecast. Now, when you do go on green, because I don't think that it's controversial that would be the correct decision there, and you get in an accident, you shouldn't think that going through green was a bad decision.
Yeah.
Now, that's totally obvious when you're talking about traffic lights. But what about when you lose your biggest client? You know, is that because you made bad decisions? Is that because you made mistakes? Or is it because you got unlucky? And we can kind of go through that, right? Let's say that you're a salesperson and you have your biggest client, and it just turns out like the person that was your point contact got fired. And you obviously don't have any control over that. So now somebody else gets promoted into the job. Maybe they come from a different company and they've been dealing with somebody else at their company, and you're just out in the street.
Yeah.
On that account. So we can ask, did you make bad decisions there? Like, what was that a bad decision, or was that just unlucky? It's very hard to know in this particular case because it's not like the traffic light, because there's all sorts of information that's hidden from view as we're trying to analyze that decision. We can certainly see the bad luck in the equation, but maybe it wasn't so unlucky in the sense that maybe that was something you could have known.
We're going to get back to the interview with Annie Duke in just a minute. Before we do, I want to let you know today's episode is also sponsored by Lightstream. So the holidays are here. And this year, you can give yourself the gift of extra money in your pocket, pay off your credit card balances, and save with a credit card consolidation loan from Lightstream. You can roll your high-interest credit card payments into just one payment at a lower fixed rate. Lightstream's credit card consolidation loans have rates as low as 5.95 APR with auto pay and excellent credit. You can get a loan from $5,000 to $100,000. Plus, there are absolutely no fees, no application fees, no origination fees, no transaction fees, no prepayment penalties. You can even get your money as soon as the day you apply, because Lightstream believes that people with good credit deserve a better loan experience, and that's exactly what they deliver. One Lightstream customer said, I heard about Lightstream while listening to one of my favorite podcasts, and it prompted me to do some more research. After shopping around for a personal loan that would help me get a lower interest rate, there was no one easier to work with. Plus, Lightstream had the best rate by far. Better yet, no fees, and I have my cash within 2 business days. Overall, amazing experience, highly recommended. So listeners to the Axon Creative Podcast can save even more with an additional interest rate discount. The only way to get this discount is to go to lightstream.com/accidental. That's lightstream.com/accidental. Of course, subject to credit approval, rates range from 5.95% APR to 19.99% APR and include a 0.5% auto pay discount. Lowest rate requires excellent credit. Terms and conditions apply and offers are subject to change without notice. Visit lightstream.com/accidental for more information. And now back to the interview with Annie Duke. I love the story about Star Wars that you shared when you were talking about this in the book. You talked about how United Artists, Universal, and Disney all passed on Star Wars, right? And
right.
Looking back, I mean, we look at that and we think, oh, what a stupid decision. But was it really a stupid decision at the moment?
Well, this happens all the time. It's like you're in a restaurant and you're trying to decide between the chicken and the fish, and you order the fish and it's yucky, and you say, oh my gosh, I made a mistake. What a stupid decision. It's like, what are you talking about? You don't have a time machine. I assume that the whole point was that you thought both of them would be equally good dishes. And absent a time machine, I'm not sure why you're calling that a stupid decision. So imagine if you're calling that a stupid decision, what happens when you find out that Star Wars, you know, which cost $11 million to make, has made, I don't know, I the numbers in my book, whatever billions of dollars the franchise has made.
Yeah.
You know, and then funnily enough, Disney was one of the studios that passed on it. And of course, they then bought it back for billions of dollars, right?
Right.
And you say, oh, that's so idiotic. But the thing is that you don't know, right? You don't know how many Star Wars-like projects that they passed on actually just ended up being flops.
Mm-hmm.
You don't know how many things that they used their budget for as opposed to Star Wars ended up making tons and tons of money, so that they didn't actually do a bad job in terms of allocating their resources. We don't know what the probability is that Star Wars actually ended up as good as it did, right? Like when somebody's making a movie and you're going into it and you don't know what the execution is going to look like, right? You can make some guesses at it and you can kind of look and say, what do we think the appetite is for sci-fi? What do we think the special effects are going to look like? Remember, at this time, people don't know, like, George Lucas is going to end up being George Lucas with his special effects, right? And they're having to make some judgment about, if we invest a dollar in this project, what do we think the return on that dollar is going to be across a range of possible outcomes, from a flop to, you know, barely making its money back, to being a modest success, to being a runaway hit, to being Star Wars. And it's like a huge range of things that this could be. And we don't know what the slate of decisions they were making across that were, what they knew. What we do know is that they did not know, and they could not know, how big a hit it was going to be. They could only know that that was a possibility.
Yeah.
So, you know, if you're beating yourself up over ordering dry chicken, this is where we really get into trouble, when we're starting to think about things that are much more complicated, like, what movie are we going to invest in? Because we don't know what all the decisions look like. We don't even know how much the studio made that year, right? The studio, the past, like, whatever, you know, Disney, they may have made tons and tons of money that year. I don't know because I haven't looked. But that's how you would start to evaluate the decision quality.
Well, and also it gets into, what were the objectives of the studio, right? Maybe it wasn't the year where they were looking to invest in a flyer film by an indie filmmaker, you know, about space pirates and, you know, creatures. And I mean, just even I can't even fathom the pitch for that movie. You know, it's kind of crazy.
Yeah. And particularly think about this, right? What was his big hit before that? American Graffiti.
Yeah.
Could you imagine watching American Graffiti and saying, this person, if they were to make a space adventure, is going to be able to make one of the best space adventure films of all time?
Right.
Right. Like, you're looking at American Graffiti. It's like a relationship film about high school kids. It's like basically the Fast Times of Ridgemont High of that era. Right. And so, you know, it's the American Pie of that era. Right. Yeah. Like, every generation seems to have one of those, like, kind of like the high school, you know, sort of nostalgia, whatever, you know, what was it? So I don't know how you look at that and you think, yeah, this person's going to make Star Wars and do an amazing job of it. Right.
Well, and this kind of gets to that. This kind of gets to the thing that you talk about in the book as well, the paradox of experience. Could you describe that concept? Because I think that plays into this a little bit, right? What is the paradox of experience?
So actually, the Star Wars example is a good one for this. Right. That's why I put it in my book, I guess. Right? I just realized, that sounded very self-congratulatory, but I promise you that was a thought that just popped into my head. Okay. So here's the paradox of experience. Experience tells you a lot in the long run, right? In the sense of, like, if we could sit back and say, there's lots and lots of outcomes that we can look at, let's look across all of these outcomes and then we'll start to learn something. It's certainly going to tell you something in the long run. But in the short run, it doesn't actually tell us very much. In the same sense as, like, if I flip a coin 10,000 times, you know quite a bit about the coin. But if I flip it once and it lands heads, you don't know much about the probability of it landing heads or tails. You only got one flip. Mm. So, but here's the problem, and this is where the paradox of experience comes in. We definitely need experience in order to be able to learn. But any individual experience can actually interfere with learning, because we act like one coin flip is enough to know a lot. So that's kind of what happens in the Star Wars example, right? Like, we can kind of see that they passed on this one thing that was going to end up being a huge hit. And then we look and we say, oh, they're all a bunch of idiots. They made terrible decisions. And you can see how that interferes with learning in the future, because then what ends up happening is that Star Wars is a huge hit. The executives that passed on it, I'm sure their heads were rolling. They may have even gotten fired. I don't know. I should go look at that. That would be interesting. But even if they didn't, I can guarantee you they started buying up sci-fi adventures because they felt like, oh, they made such a big mistake to pass on Star Wars. But maybe Star Wars was like lightning in a bottle and you needed specifically like a relatively unknown cast combined with George Lucas and the state of special effects that occurred at exactly that moment in time in order to end up with Star Wars. And that, no, you can't actually just say across the board, we shouldn't have passed on that. So let's just go buy a bunch of Star Wars films that remind me of it. And you can actually see this happen in television all the time. I don't, you know, if you think about something like a show like Friends, when that became a hit, what ended up happening was there were all these shows that all of a sudden appeared on television, which were like a quirky group of friends, but this time they're in LA. And of course they all failed.
Right.
But that's what comes of resulting. Which is, I think I know so much from a single outcome that therefore I know whether the decision quality was good or bad. And we're not thinking about what the process was for actually figuring out whether you should buy that. We're just sort of looking and saying, shows like Friends are good decisions because it was a hit. Hmm. And so I should make decisions like that.
And this is part of the challenge, I think, of a lot of industries where people have a couple of quick hits and then everybody just assumes that their intuition must be so great because they had a couple of quick hits. Well, it could have been the result of luck, right? It could have just been that they happened at the right place at the right time and they made the right deal or bought the right thing. And then everybody puts all their eggs in that person's intuition. But the reality is, as you said, it's this resulting thing where, you know, all of a sudden we think they have the golden touch, but maybe they just got lucky a couple times.
I'll give you a great example of that right in this moment in time, which is I don't have enough information to know whether the people who founded Zoom or the people who invested in Zoom made really good decisions. Hmm. I don't have enough information about it because I don't know what that process looked like. I don't know what the pitch looked like. I don't know what the size of the market was or how crowded the market was or what the competitive space looked like. I know none of that. Okay, so I don't know. But this is what I do know, is that they aren't as much of a genius as everybody thinks they are today. Because I am just willing to bet a lot of money that when Zoom was founded and when people were investing in that business or even buying that stock, that they didn't have pandemic on their bingo card.
Right.
So here's a situation where they may or may not be quite good. Like, I'm not saying that I think that they're not, that they aren't great founders or that they didn't create a great company or they didn't have an insight that other people didn't have. I'm not saying that. I'm saying I don't know. What I do know is that the success that it has today, that wasn't in the decision space, right? But this is what happens, is that now you can imagine that everybody looks and says, oh, that's the founder of Zoom, like the biggest genius in the world. Maybe so, but I don't know. But they're doing it because of basically the fact that Zoom took off in a pandemic.
Yeah.
And again, they may be a total genius. I'm not saying anything about the founder of Zoom. They may be a total genius, but not for the reason that people are calling them a genius.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think that that's, you know, again, you have to look at things over a very long period of time. That's like your coin flip, right? It's kind of hard to know whether you can look at Jeff Bezos and say, yeah, that guy's pretty smart. Like, you know, I mean, he's managed to do something over a long period of time and continue to grow it. But if Amazon had stopped at just selling books online, you might be like, well, I don't know, you know, maybe.
I don't know. Like Barnes and Noble ended up eating him alive, you
right.
know?
Yeah, exactly.
So, yeah, I mean, that's exactly right. And that's why we want to look at these things and understand. I need to understand what the decision process is. That's why I keep saying that. If I could look at the pitch deck for Zoom and I could understand what the insight was and how they were thinking about the space, then I could know something about the genius or whatever of the founders and the investors in that company and so on and so forth. But absent that information, which I don't have, this particular coin flip, it's like, it feels like they just flipped 10 heads in a row on a coin that was 50-50.
Yeah.
To me.
Yeah.
So you know, who knows what it means.
For sure. Yeah. Tell us a little bit about the Alliance for Decision Education.
Oh, gosh. Thank you so much for asking me about that. So all the stuff that we're talking about right now, which is how do you really understand what an outcome means, right? Does it mean the decision was good or bad? How do you think about decisions? What are the things that I would need to know in order to know what a good decision was, which we've talked about, right? I have to know what the information is that somebody had at the time. That's what I'm saying about the Zoom case, right? I need to think about my decisions as forecasts of the future and understand that there's all sorts of different ways that things can turn out. And they have different probabilities. And what I'm really trying to do with my decision making is figure out a decision that's going to get me a good result more of the time. But that's really what I'm trying to do. And when we think about our lives, in fact, there's only two things that determine how your life turns out. One is luck, and you can't do anything about that. The other is the quality of your decisions. You can do quite a bit about that. And it's something that adults think about quite a bit. It's something that has become very popular in the literature, things like Thinking Fast and Slow, obviously, by Daniel Kahneman, Super Forecasting by Phil Tetlock, The Success Equation by Michael Mobison. I mean, I can go on. There's so many amazing books, but if you just start there, you'll end up finding a lot of them. There, you know, people really thinking about how do we really improve human decision making. The place that we haven't seen that get expressed is in K through 12 education. So we've learned all of this stuff about the weaknesses of human judgment, how you can strengthen human judgment, how you should think about decisions, how you should think about outcomes. How do you become a better decision maker? How do you understand the influence of luck? And it's not in our K through 12 education. We're spending all this time teaching people trigonometry. And we're not teaching them how to be better decision makers. And I think that that's actually a much more important mission, particularly in the information ecosystem that we live in right now, where it's really important to understand what's true and what's not. Because if you can't get that down, it's hard to make good decisions. So what we're doing at the Alliance for Decision Education is really trying to build the field of decision education and build velocity behind it and momentum behind that into K through 12 education. In the same way that, just to give people an analogy, for anybody who has young kids, they know that their kids are getting social and emotional learning in school. And that didn't used to be a thing. You know, a decade ago, that was not a thing in schools. But some people who are really passionate about the importance of social emotional learning really helped to build momentum behind bringing that kind of education into K through 12. And that's what we're trying to do with decision education.
I love that. That is so needed. I know even just in my own little world here, we have an 18-year-old son that just turned 18. I'm going to have him read your book, How to Decide, because I felt like it was so unbelievably practical. And as he's going off to college, I think this is just going to help him make much better decisions, or at least be better, more aware of why he's making decisions the way that he's making them. And I know I found it profoundly helpful as well. The book's called How to Decide: Simple Tools for Making Better Choices. The author is Annie Duke. Annie, thanks so much for taking the time to be with us today.
Oh, well, thank you for having me. This was a fun conversation.
And as always, thank you for listening. If you enjoyed this episode, make sure you subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts or at accidentalcreative.com. Remember, friends, cover bands don't change the world. Don't be a cover band. You need to find your unique voice if you want to thrive. We'll see you next time. I'm gonna take it.